When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, 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 and welcome to I Know That Face, the only podcast which honours the often underappreciated by the masses work of character actors. I'm Stephen Portio.
My name's Andrew Carroll.
And today we are doing something different, however. We are recapping our top five movies of 2023. 2023, great year for movies.
Really good. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously Barbenheimer phenomenon. Yeah. Really fun seeing friends who wouldn't be as into cinema as us getting hyped about that.
Sorry, my notes are on my phone. That's why I'm...
Yeah, I was wondering.
I'm not paying attention to you. Yeah, it really was the year of the blockbuster.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning.
Yeah. Which didn't do that well, but...
also didn't do that well, Dungeons & Dragons.
But it feels like they were back in a big way. You know, studios were placing bets again.
Sure. Guardians of Galaxy 3. Solid, I like.
Solid, yeah. Every other superhero film that came out this year.
Well, Spider-Man not so solid. Across the Spider-Verse.
That's true, yeah.
That was pretty
good. That's a cartoon for babies and children.
You're making that argument. That's usually my thing.
Yeah, no.
But also, like,
jokingly making that argument, I should say.
Auteurs making very interesting movies on a kind of blockbuster scale, if they weren't really blockbusters.
Yeah.
Like, you know, obviously Barbie and Oppenheimer, but also Killers of the Flower Moon, Napoleon, Babylon, The Killer. Babylon, kind of a 2022 movie.
Well,
I'm still getting confused about the years, but it came out in Ireland in January.
Which is why it's on my list.
But I thought what was cool was that there were often like 2, 3, or 4 interesting films to go to and see in the cinemas at like one time, like throughout the year, maybe 1 or 2 weeks. It was a bit like thin on the ground, maybe because of the writer's strike. But like, between multiplexes and art house, like, there was a lot of good stuff. And it was, like, good, like, even if not top 20 material, just, like, entertaining thrillers and horrors. Like, I wrote down, like, Knock at the Cabin, Pope's Exorcist, Saltburn, A Haunting in Venice, Thanksgiving.
Yeah, Thanksgiving was so good.
It was so good.
Yeah.
Comedies as well, like Theatre Camp, Rye Lane, Bottoms, or... these kind of pump-your-fist kind of underdog dramas, like Air or Dumb Money. Like, they were all, like, pretty good. I saw like 105 new movies, and I would say like 90 of them were like 3 stars and above. So I was like,
Stephen Threzio strikes again.
And then like, he also had like really fascinating art house films like Night at the 12th or Past Lives, The Beasts, Fallen Leaves, A Fire, Reality, Beau's Afraid. Really inventive Irish sci-fi, Lola. Just want to give a shout out. And then like the reissue of Stop Making Sense. Probably the best thing I saw in cinemas this year, but I'm not putting it on my list because it's not a 2023 movie.
I don't think I've ever willingly listened to a Talking Heads song.
Well, you don't like Talking Heads?
Psycho Killer, I know.
You don't like Once in a Lifetime?
I couldn't even tell you. I couldn't even
let
hum you.
Let the days go by.
Yeah,
I think you'd love Talking Heads.
Maybe you're right, but I've never like willingly gone for him, you know?
Life During Wartime? No, you don't know that? Anyway. Before we get into our top fives, any honorable mentions?
Dungeons & Dragons, as you said. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, Part 1. I always have a soft spot for that. Skinamarink.
Still haven't seen Skinamarink.
Yeah, really. I saw that in February, and the whole time I was watching it, the hour and 40 minutes, I was like, it's kind of boring.
Sure.
It's kind of dull.
That's what put me off watching.
Yeah, and then I left the theater and I had full body chills for like 20 minutes. So,
might have just been February weather.
Could have been. Yeah, but it was internal. You know.
Sure.
I saw the kind of companion picture to Skinamarink, The Outwaters, illegally because it hasn't been released here.
It was my birthday at the weekend, and I got a copy of it on DVD.
Holy shit!
Yeah,
nice.
So I'm excited to watch that.
Yeah, well, enjoy. It's certainly more exciting than Skinamarink. I will say that much during watching it anyway. Past Lives I really loved.
Great. My 20 to 6, just unletterboxed, I'll just run it down quickly. Master Gardener, Paul Schrader's, the completion of his trilogy of First Reformed and Card Counter. Fair Play, great little Netflix thriller. Blackberry with one of the best performances of the year, Glenn Harrodin. Fallen Leaves, the beautiful Finnish romantic drama, comedy
Aki
drama.
Aki Kaurismäki.
Barbie, The Beasts, really good French-Spanish thriller. May-December, Todd Haynes's latest. Todd Haynes, just one of the most consistent directors.
Knocks it out of the park every time. I've seen any of his films.
Yeah, you have. We talked about Dark Waters and whatever.
Oh, that one, yeah. That one's good. I've seen that one.
You Hurt My Feelings.
Sorry, Stephen.
No.
Film.
Yes. Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Tobias Menzies, lovely comedy. Babylon, Fablemans, Royal Hotel, great Australian thriller.
I've heard of it.
The Killer, Past Lives, Pearl, which we've talked about many times on the podcast, and Eileen was my six. Do you want to start with your number five?
Yeah, sure. So I went with something a little different this year because I'm not a big list person. My top five generally change day to day, so I decided to pick five films that sort of best represent why I love movies or loved going to the movies. You know, epic stories, being scared, a great love story.
Nicole Kidman here, Jesus.
I know, yeah. Sort of a
heartbreak feels good in a place like this.
It does, in this podcast studio that we have to rush through because I was late. Sort of a complex film that forces you to think and ask questions of it and yourself, and then just my overall favorite of the year. So I'm going to start out with something, a movie near and dear to my heart, Babylon, the 2023 Irish release date. Damien Chazelle epic sort of silent cinema into sound story. So Manny, played by Diego Calva, is a studio gopher for Kinoscope Studios in 1926. At one of its executives' debauched parties, Manny meets self-proclaimed rising star Nelly LaRoy, played by Margot Robbie, established leading man Jack Crawford, played by Brad Pitt, African-American jazz trumpeter Sidney Palmer, played by Joe Van Adepo, and lesbian cabaret singer Lady Fei Zhu, played by Lee Jun Lee. These chance meetings establish Manny in the studio system and lead to the rise and fall of everyone he meets at the party as cinema moves from silent movies to sound.
If you could go anywhere in the whole world, where would you go?
I always wanted to be part of something bigger.
Yes.
Let's go! Something that lasts, that means something.
You know, when I first moved to L.A.,
You
know what the signs on all the doors read? No actors or dogs allowed. I changed that.
Good morning.
Good job for you.
I'll do anything.
That's the cocksucker they sent to screw us.
Yeah! This bitch is stealing the scene right from under me. She's icing her nipples so they perk up through her dress.
I ain't icing my nipples. This is natural. Where do you say we come in for my close-up now?
So it's sort of an epic story about the beginning of feature films as we now know them and the birth of the monstrosity that is the studio system as we now know it. So it's a colourful, hedonistic black comedy that has 189 minutes. Definitely feels shaggy and definitely feels epic. It's that one straining and energising and absorbing. It never feels like it's putting shocking stuff in it for the sake of it, I would argue. Anyone that knows anything about it, or maybe it is, and, you know, just as a quiet little fuck you to whoever doesn't like that kind of thing. There was one walk out of my screening where that guy was eating rats in that underground dungeon party and this old couple got up and left. And so anyone that knows anything about old Hollywood would reasonably expect that these kind of parties fueled by champagne and cocaine happened, but that maybe not all of them involved elephant shit.
First scene.
I know, yeah. Yeah, literally the first 5 minutes of the film, this guy gets shit on by an elephant and you're like, well, I know where this is going. I liked how long and epic it felt. It was, even because, like The Wolf of Wall Street, it might be full of things that aren't completely necessary or that people might not want to see, but God damn it, it's never boring and always fun to watch. And we've often talked about how the scene where Nelly fights a rattlesnake in Babylon feels unnecessary and should be cut, but then the full film would be missing the establishment of a relationship with the Lady Fei Zhu, as well as Margot Robbie fighting a rattlesnake.
Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Eric Roberts.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think every time, I saw a tweet earlier this year that was like, every time, you know, he's doing like Dr. Death 3, Hospital of Nightmares, and then every so often he goes onto a film like Babylon and he's like, ooh, catering.
Yeah, like Inherent Vice.
Yeah. And it's full of like, I know that faces that, some of whom we will eventually do, such as Lucas Haas, Max Minghella, Catherine Waterston, Tobey Maguire, Flea, Jeff Garlin, Eric Roberts, as mentioned, and Samara Weaving in a lovely bit of stunt casting opposite Margot Robbie. And then casting Spike Jonze as an insane German director is the cherry on top of this cake.
So funny.
That always feels like it's about to topple.
Yeah, for sure. Great soundtrack.
So yeah.
Made my soundtrack of the year. The real jazzy.
I think I love Oppenheimer's soundtrack the most, I think.
Oh, that's a good tune too. Yeah.
Can you hear the music?
Yes, I can. So good. Yeah, no, I love Babylon. A real movie that really grew in my head. I think first time I watched it, I was like, my kind of debate was that, like, is Chazelle, because I've seen La La Land and it's such a lovely movie, and then you see this movie that's really depraved and it's really throwing in the face all the depravity, and I was a little bit like, is this authentic Chazelle or is he just trying to shock? But the more I've sat with the movie, and the more like, there is a point to everything. And he's making a point that I don't think I've seen a movie make before, which is that, like, movies are incredible, but like, the system that makes movies is inherently messed up.
Yeah.
And it always has been.
Yeah.
Which is cool. And I really love the ending as well. My number five is How to Blow Up a Pipeline. So this is an indie action thriller based on the nonfiction book of the same name by Andreas Malm. Haven't read the book, but it functions as a criticism of the current nonviolence and pacifism in the climate activist movement, arguing that sabotaging devices that produce CO2 emissions to discourage new investment in them is a logical form of climate activism. And so using this source material as a jumping off point, writer-director Daniel Goldhaber, who made a pretty good little horror movie a couple years ago called Cam. Did you ever see that?
I've heard of it, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. And his co-writers, Jordan Soule and Ariella Barrer, crafted this action thriller about a group of young people, one of whom, sort of the lead character, is played by Barrer herself, who gather at a remote cabin in West Texas for a few days in order to execute their plan of blowing up a pipeline.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Boom Talk. Today, teaching myself to make a homemade blasting cap.
If this works, it'll be step one in making our own improvised explosive.
Might be headed to Texas for the winter.
What's in Texas?
This project.
What kind of project?
Trying to stop the pipeline from being built on my property. Poisons the air, water.
Damn, this place is sick. You guys cooking meth in here?
I'm ready to start working.
We have to show how vulnerable the oil industry is by hitting something big.
Michael, what do you think the odds are we blow ourselves up?
I don't really care.
And has the same structure a heist movie might have, so the character's efforts in and around this like Texas cabin to pull off the job, you know, preparing explosives, taking out the oil company's drone, shutting off the pipeline's flow so that when it explodes, there's no like local pollution. This is juxtaposed with flashbacks throughout the film as to why every character has committed to this plan. And I think in a heist movie, it would be like, I need money to support my sick family, or, you know, I want to fulfill my dream of opening a business. Here, it's like, some of the people have been made sick or have had relatives made sick by pollution. Some have had their land destroyed by pollution. Some, like Malm in his book, are just frustrated that this pacifist approach is just like not working.
Mm.
And then there are just members of the team that are like adrenaline seekers, you know, like, and they're played memorably by Christine Froseth and Lucas Gage, and they kind of provide the comic relief. I love crime thrillers generally, but I think adding an eco element to them can make them more interesting and give them a greater depth, because the characters are committing these actions not out of personal gain, but out of altruism, like in their view to help and, you know, protect society. Mm. And you can have that same debate within the movie that society often has when it comes to these sort of radical environmentalists that commit actions like this, is that, like, is this terrorism, or as Barrer's character says in How to Blow Up a Pipeline, is it an act of self-defense? But even putting all that aside, like, incredibly well made. The scenes where they handle the explosives in this have the same sort of tautness as the sequences in one of your favorites, William Freakin' Sorcerer. Mm. You know, their anti-heroes are like transporting the nitroglycerin. Screenplay does this very clever thing where, for the present day sequences prepping for the explosion, the film is just like dropping the viewer immediately into the situation without too much exposition. You know, from the title, the basics of what's happening. Like, it's very process oriented, like you're just watching them through this whole stressful process. And there's this like incredibly tense score by Gavin Breivik, which is a mix of distorted synths and recordings of oil drums being banged in the desert.
Ooh.
Really cool. But this is all cut with flashbacks, which at first you think might just function as sort of explainers for as to, you know, how the characters got in this situation. But as the film continues, the flashbacks become stealthily key to understanding the group's overall plan. And it has a few tricks up its sleeve in that respect, which I loved. A shout out Barra, Frozeth, and Gage already, but the whole young cast is terrific. Sasha Lane is in this. She's always great. To me, though, the standout cast member is Forrest Goodluck, probably best known for playing Leonardo DiCaprio's son in The Revenant.
Huh.
He plays Michael, the group's self-taught explosives maker, and he's a part of the group because his Native American reservation is being polluted by a big corporation. And he's really angsty and antisocial, but also like reserved and quiet. He only really speaks when he has something important to say. And it's these elements and this like incredible focus that he possesses that makes him really good at handling explosive materials, and just a really interesting, captivating, dryly funny performance. I think I floated the idea to you of maybe doing our own Oscars
episode this year.
And I he would be a contender for me for best supporting actor.
Yeah, cool.
And like every movie in my top five, really memorable final scene here. So yeah. That's my number five.
Yeah, cool. Four? Sure. So my number four is Godzilla Minus One.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So, kamikaze pilot Koichi Shikishima, played by Ryunosuke Kamiki, feigns technical issues with his plane and lands it on Odo Island. That night, almost the entire garrison except Koichi is killed by an enormous dinosaur the locals call Godzilla. 2 years later, Koichi is living with fellow survivor Noriko Oishi, played by Minami Hamabe, and a child they rescued from the ruins of Tokyo. Working on a minesweeper ship and plagued by survivor's guilt, Koichi and his crewmates, the kid, played by Yuki Yamada, the doc, Hidetaka Yoshioka, and the captain, Kuronosuke Sasaki, encounter Godzilla a second time, and this time he's bigger and angrier. With tensions high between America and the Soviets, it's up to the ex-soldiers and sailors of Japan to take the fight to Godzilla. So this year was bookended by two great moments in horror movies. The first was the Megan doll singing Sia's Titanium in Megan, which is very funny. And the second is less funny and more in line with the horror genre, and that's Godzilla roaring at the sky after devastating Tokyo with his atomic heat ray, while a black radioactive rain begins to fall as Koichi screams at the sky in tandem with the monster. And it's like, yes, cinema! And also, Jesus Christ, the nuclear metaphor. So it's a remix of the original 1954 Godzilla movie that also takes clear inspiration from Jurassic Park in its opening sequence, Jaws in a middle of the movie boat chase sequence, and Dunkirk in its climax, but it also resolutely remains its own beast. And Godzilla Minus One is obvious in one sense in the monster's metaphor for nuclear weapons and their devastating consequences, but like the original film, it expresses something inexpressible in its destructive action and melodramatic performances. The attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were devastating war crimes that killed tens of thousands of people. Japan is unfortunately unique in its status as the only nation thus far to have a nuclear weapon used against it as an act of war. And the effect this kind of attack, let alone two of them, can have on a country, its population, and a population yet to be born, is inestimable from a cultural standpoint. And Japan would not be the same country it is today had it been spared these attacks. Godzilla is only one part of the cultural response to the bombings, but he is also the most famous. And throughout his 70-year history, Godzilla has been many things: a metaphor, a monster, a hero, and a goofball. Much like 2016's Shin Godzilla, however, Godzilla Minus One returns the creature to his horrifying roots as an almost unstoppable force of destruction, repaying mankind's atomic crimes in kind every time he leaves the ocean. Only the will and determination of the ordinary Japanese people can hope to defeat the monster where the military might, or lack thereof, has failed to do so. So it's nationalistic and certainly can be seen as advocating for increased Japanese militarization, which historically has never been a good thing for Asia and the wider world. But it's also a certified crowd pleaser that wears its heart in its sleeve and is unafraid of tackling big displays of tough emotions. It's frankly no better or worse than Top Gun Maverick in terms of being military propaganda, but it also has similar fist-pumping, cheer-worthy moments that Maverick does. And it also has one thing Top Gun Maverick doesn't have.
Godzilla.
Godzilla.
No, I didn't get a chance to see it in cinema yet, but I'm hoping I will still, because it's been a big hit. And
yeah,
it's been really nice to see that and Boy and the Heron doing so well. In like, it got released in like the Odeon, my local.
Yeah, you know? Same here. Yeah.
So that's really cool.
Yeah. I saw Godzilla Minus One in IMAX in my Odeon.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah.
It's like the dream. I think as much as you can like criticize like streamers or whatever, I do think Netflix has helped with people are more open to checking out something in a foreign language now than they might have been a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Night of the 12th, speaking of foreign language movies, this is a French crime thriller based on a true crime book. The movie actually won 6 awards, including Best Film at the Césars, the French version of the Oscars. The movie begins with the grisly murder of a young woman named Clara, played by Lula Cotton Frappier, as she is walking home one night in a sleepy French suburb. She was burned to death. And an opening,
Jesus.
I know, it's pretty shocking opening to the movie. And an opening title card states that this was one of many unsolved murders in France. So from there, we follow two cops investigating the killer, Johan, played by Bastien Boullion, a young, fresh-faced, recently promoted police captain, and Marceau, played by Bully Lanier, an older, hot-headed, world-weary detective. And this movie is directed by Dominic Moll. I was really impressed by it managing to be so compelling and engrossing from the jump, despite letting viewers know that Central Mystery is going to be an unsolved one, and the ways in which Moll and his co-writer Guillaume Marchand managed to accomplish that. Bill Gabeiri did a very good review of the movie, in which he compared it to Memories of Murder and Zodiac, stating, "Its real-world mysteries eventually become existential ones, but the film never stops sending chills up your spine." I think it's so on the money, because as the cops investigate Clara's murder, they interview multiple suspects, men who are in Clara's life, and one suspect is a rapper who wrote a song and posts online describing killing Clara in exactly the same way she was murdered. Another is a history of domestic abuse. One can't stop laughing while being interrogated, but all of the main suspects have alibis.
Okay.
And Johan and his team are shocked at this, with Johan saying at one point, like, none of them did it, but all of them, like, could have done it.
Mm.
And also at points in the movie, Johan catches members of his police team making jokes or speaking dismissively about Clara and her death. And the movie becomes a portrait of how, like, shocking crimes like this can often highlight big issues in society. In this case, this kind of deep-rooted misogyny. At one point, Johan is summarizing the case for a judge who encourages him to, like, revisit the investigation after some time has passed. And he says something's wrong between men and women. So it's exploring a very important, always very timely topic. It also comes a movie about just the toll this case takes on the investigators and their frustrations at not being able to deliver justice. It's like for Johan and Marceau, this unsolved case is like throwing the cosmos out of whack for them.
Yeah.
Moll manages to make the movie feel very visually compelling and dramatic without ever being sensational. It has sort of a somber procedural like tone, a bit like Spotlight, but there's like nice little visual motifs that run through the movie. Johan lets off steam by cycling around a racetrack in a circle, and it's a good metaphor for him kind of running around in circles in the case, never moving anywhere. It's like a hamster on a wheel. There's also two moments in this movie that are just among the most unsettling things I've ever seen, or at least I've seen in a movie this year. They both revolve around mysterious figures emerging from darkness at shrines for Clara while they're being under surveillance, and they feel like they could be out of Memories of Murder or Zodiac. So yeah, it's a very impressive piece of work, and I'm surprised it hasn't shown up on more end of year lists.
Yeah, I remember you ranking it really highly and then just kind of never finding the time for it, I guess, which is really my own fault.
Yeah.
Anyway, onto something.
Be better than 2024. No.
Apologies. anyway, onto something a bit more cheerful. Asteroid City is my number three.
Okay.
So bereaved war photographer Augie Steenbeck, played by Jason Schwartzman, brings his teenage son Woodrow, played by Jake Ryan, and three young daughters to the Junior Stargazers Convention in the southwestern American desert town of Asteroid City. There, Augie meets actress Midge Campbell. Midge Campbell. Scarlett Johansson, and a great many other characters, too many to name here, while under quarantine after an alien, played by Jeff Goldblum and puppeteered by Kim Kukilur, steals the eponymous asteroid of Asteroid City.
Junior stargazers and space cadets, each year we celebrate Asteroid Day, commemorating September 23rd, 3007 BC, when the Arid Plains meteorite made Earth impact.
Holy Toledo, that's Mitch Campbell.
You're very good in the one about the tramp in the brothel
gets
amnesia and becomes a pediatrician. You were very awesome.
Actually, maybe my favorite character I've ever
seen. I don't know why nobody else liked it.
Oh.
What do those pulses indicate?
What? Oh, the beeps and blips? We don't know.
Some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate. Anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know, Billy?
Except now there's an alien.
What's happening now?
I don't know.
So that's a really simplified plot breakdown. Asteroid City is actually the title of a fictional play written by Conrad Earp, played by Edward Norton, and directed by Shubert Green, played by Adrian Brody, the production of which is documented by a 1950s TV anthology show about the arts. This frame story gets a bit looser the longer the movie goes on, but I will admit that it's Wes Anderson's maybe hardest film to get into in terms of like how it's framed.
I agree.
Thank you, Stephen. So why do I like it so much? Oh yeah, I have to answer that. there are similar themes here that appear in his previous work, namely grief, love, fractured families, the wisdom of the youth, the wisdom of the young even, and the selfish folly of the supposedly mature. But it's here that I feel that these themes are the most fully developed out of all his films. More than his usual stable of players, Anderson now attracts big talents from outside his spheres, such as Johansson and Tom Hanks, that he easily absorbs into his broken clockwork worlds. And obviously we're more used to seeing the likes of Willem Dafoe's ferrety weirdos, Adrian Brody's suave losers, and Edward Norton's neurotic authority figures than we are to Hanks's choked emotion or Johansson's disaffected depression. But that's part of what makes Asteroid City so special and unique. Anderson's willingness to update his playhouse with passing stars while keeping the bedrock of his cast so solid. And the main themes of the movie play out through these broken people trying at last to fix themselves and finding reasons to keep living in an isolated desert town. Really is Anderson's Bad Day at Black Rock or Paris, Texas. It's the youngest stars that shine the brightest here, however, where Augie, Midge and the other adults' grief and ennui threatens to collapse them and turn them into black holes. It's the young love of Woodrow and his crush and fellow stargazer Dina, played by Grace Edwards. Clifford, played by Aristo Meehan, who is JJ's son, who's played by Liv Schreiber. Fear of being unnoticed, and Ricky, played by Ethan Josh Lee, who's Roger Cho's son, who's played by Stephen Park. Open defiance of the US military industrial complex that feels so funny and inspiring and just fills you full of hope. And I should also mention Augie's three young daughters who regularly and chaotically steal the show in the movie. And I think much like my choice last year of Decision to Leave, my choice of Asteroid City this year might confuse some people, particularly Stephen. And again, that might be due to the film's ending. Or maybe you just like the film for an entirely different reason. Who knows? Anyway, without spoilers, here's my interpretation of it. If anyone can benefit from it, I hope you do. So there's the lines towards the end where the actor playing Augie Steenbeck, also played by Jason Schwartzman, turns to Schubert Green and says, "I don't understand the play." And Schubert Green says, "It doesn't matter. Just keep telling the story." Yeah. And the refrain of "You can't wake up if you don't fall asleep" are linked inextricably, you might say. So Asteroid City is a film at its heart about grief and trying to find a way out of that seemingly endless darkness. And grief will often leave people in a state of numbness, almost a state of sleep, if you will. And as we all know, you can't wake up if you don't fall asleep. So what's important on this road to recovery is not the destination, the cure, if you will, but the journey. Augie might not understand why he needs to go through this, and neither does Jones Hall, the actor playing him. But as we can interpret from Schubert Green, it doesn't matter if you don't know where you're going or how you're going to get there. You'll know the where, why, and how at the end. For now, just keep going. Just keep telling the story.
I dislike it strong. Like, I enjoyed the movie as I was watching it because, like, obviously performances are great, looks amazing. It is a bit like Bad Day at Black Rock in terms of the aesthetics. It was the first Wes Anderson movie for me where the framing device didn't really click. And I was a bit like, I kind of would rather have just watched them in the desert.
That's a fair point, yeah. And I
kind of kept, I was actually getting invested in like My Hawk and Rupert Friend. And then the movie keeps being like, this is fake. Yeah. I was like, all right. But I know people are having deeper readings of it, so maybe it would benefit from a rewatch. And, you know, French Dispatch was a movie that kind of I wasn't mad on, and it kind of grew in my head since I've seen it.
They grow in your mind. I think all Wes Anderson movies grow in your mind. Like, I didn't like most of the or any of the shorts he did this year, the Roald Dahl ones, but I'm sure if I watch them again I'll find new things in them.
I only saw two of them. I like The Swan. It's a Rupert Friend one. He's been bullied.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
As you heard in the intro, this show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, Ireland's largest network of independent podcasts. There's plenty of other great shows to check out on the network. Here's a taster of one.
Hello, my name is Dave Coffey, and I'm the host of Phoning It In, the hilarious improvised phone-in show. It's like Joe Duffy's Live Line, except we make it all up on the spot. We've got a back catalogue of over 100 episodes featuring some of the best comedy performers in the country. People like Kevin McGahern, Alison Spittle, Killian Sunderman, Shane Dan Byrne, Joanne McNally, Michael Fry, Emma Doran, Peter McGann, Hannah Mamelis, Tony Cantwell, and so many more. Join me, Dave Coffey, for Phoning It In right here on the Headstuff Podcast Network.
I know that Face are also delighted to finally get to tell listeners about Headstuff Plus. Headstuff Plus is the one-stop shop for everything on the Headstuff Podcast Network, Ireland's largest podcast network and the one to which I Know That Face belongs. If you're a fan of I Know That Face or any other shows on the network, become a member of Headstuff Plus and get bonus episodes of Headstuff shows, other exclusive content, merchandise, early access to live events, and lots more. We here at I Know That Face have already recorded a handful of bonus episodes where myself and Andrew talk about more current news and releases in the world of film and TV. But also in the future, we have plans for more actor-themed series as well, along with releasing episode outtakes, accompanying articles, etc., all for Headstuff Plus subscribers. To sign up to Headstuff Plus, it's just €5 plus VAT per month. When you sign up, no matter what show or shows you are supporting, you still get access to everything, all the bonus material for all the podcasts on the network. A lot of great podcasts. Plus, by doing so, you'll be supporting I Know The Face to bring you more top material. For all the details and to sign up, visit headstuffpodcasts.com.
And now, back to the show. My number three is Leave the World Behind from writer director Sam Esmail, best known for creating Mr. Robot, and he adapted this from Rumina Alum's 2020 acclaimed novel of the same name. It centers around a New York family called the Sanfords, comprising of two kids and their parents, played by Ethan Hawke and Julia Roberts, who rent a secluded idyllic house in Long Island for a getaway. However, while there, a strange thing happens, and then at night, they are visited by a man, played by Mahershala Ali, who owns the house, and his daughter, adult daughter, played by Malala Harold, and they basically explain, like, look, we know you rented the house, but there's been a blackout in New York City, and could we stay here with you? And the film basically explores the relationship between these two families who don't really trust each other in this secluded house as society around them appears to collapse.
Oh, this is nice. Kids look so happy.
The Wi-Fi isn't working. Get a pad.
I'm so sorry to bother you, but this is our house.
This is your house?
Driving back to the city, then something happened.
You want to stay here, but we're staying here.
We need to get them out of here.
They need to think everything's gonna be okay.
Everything is gonna be okay, isn't it?
We are seeing ongoing cyber attacks across the country.
Apparently the novel is less about the apocalypse, but more about how characters deal with an apocalyptic situation they don't understand.
Boring!
And the book is said to stick pretty close to the characters, and as such doesn't really provide answers about like what has led to society collapsing. Mm. What Esmail has done is very ambitious. You know, he's like taken this character-driven, intimate source material and has stayed true to it while also blowing out the story into the type of thing that you might see in a big budget Hollywood movie like Bird Box or The Happening or the 2023 movie we both like, Knock at the Cabin. So he's done that by one huge stars, you know, Roberts, Hawke, Ali, Kevin Bacon, who I didn't mention, who has a small but pivotal part in the movie and just reminds us why he's one of the greats. Two, adding in several huge set pieces while also staying pretty close to the rental home. Three, sprinkling into the story more hints and Easter eggs as to what could be the cause for the apocalypse while also remaining enigmatic about the whole thing. And four, getting Netflix behind the movie, who can just stick this in front of as many eyeballs as possible. And critics seem to like it, although I know some are frustrated with the changes to the source material. Audiences in general seem extremely polarized on it. Many people seeing it as kind of all build up, no payoff. Maybe just because I love these kind of B movies of ordinary people trapped in a mad sci-fi situation. And especially when like an auteur is making them. Mm. But I loved this pretty much across the board. Like I think in the movie nails the big visual spectacle. There's a sequence where an oil tanker runs aground, spectacular. There's a action scene involving self-driving Teslas that's amazing. The movie's split up into sections, and the second of which is called The Curve, and it's centered around multiple characters leaving the rental home on these kind of separate journeys. And even though I wouldn't call Leave the World Behind a horror per se, like it's the most dread-inducing scene I've seen in the movie all year. It features incredible homage to Hitchcock, North by Northwest. But I think the movie's as strong in the claustrophobic parts. It's kind of asking, like, can basic human decency persist in the face of rapid societal collapse? Roberts' character, Amanda's misanthropic. She has this maybe slightly overwritten monologue at the beginning of the movie, which ends with her saying, "I fucking hate people." And she's very distrustful of Ali and Harold's characters, G-hatred Ruth, when they show up at her doorstep, and you wonder as a factor of that, like, racism. Bacon plays, like, this doomsday prepper who lives nearby, who Ali and Hawke's characters go to desperately for help, and Bacon turns them away, and Ali's character is like, come on, man, we know each other, we're friends. And he's like, that's the old way, George. You're not thinking clearly. Nothing makes a whole lot of sense right now. When the world doesn't make sense, I can still do what's rational, which is protect my own. And the situation turns into a Mexican standoff. And Hawk starts crying, being like, I have no idea what to do right now. I can barely do anything without my cell phone. I'm a useless man. Great stuff. All sounds grim and tense, but the film is also quite funny and very humanist in parts. There's a whole subplot about how Amanda and Clay's, that's Hawk's character's young daughter, Rose, played by Farrah McKenzie, has just binge-watched Friends and has only one more episode left. And it starts as a joke because society is falling apart around her and she's like, I really need to see a Ross and Rachel like end, you know, like, how does that happen? But then it becomes this very sincere depiction of how people crave comfort and entertainment in times of crisis. I know some people hate the movie's ending. I wish I could talk about it more in depth without spoiling it, but I think it's one of the most unique, thought-provoking things I've seen in a long time. So, yeah, three. Fair enough. Behind.
Do you want to head straight into your number two? Because it's my... Or,
that's fair. Oh,
yeah, because your number one is my number two, so...
Exactly.
I'll just talk about my number one after this, and then we can talk about your number one.
Perfect. Tar. So.
I have seen that.
Yes, revolves around a very renowned figure in the world of composing and conducting named Lydia Tar, played by Cate Blanchett, an Oscar-nominated turn, who faces an increasingly public reckoning.
We have a problem.
I received another weird email.
There's no reason to get caught up in any intrigue.
I'm worried. She's starting to disappear into herself.
You want to dance the mask? You must service the composer. You gotta sublimate yourself. Your ego and, yes, your identity.
You must, in fact, stand in front of the public and God and obliterate yourself.
This garnered a lot of acclaim, but also provoked a lot of discussion for its explorations of topics that have dominated talk around the entertainment industry in the past few years, like cancel culture, separating the art from the artist, power dynamics. Explores these matters with a lot of thought, but also in a way that's not hand-holding to the viewer, and puts a lot of faith in audiences that they will engage with the film story and come up with their own interpretation about what that all means, what they should take away from it. And I don't think a lot of movies really do that anymore.
True, yeah.
So I think that's one reason Tar stood out to me. And I also think Leave the World Behind and my number one is a bit like that too. But I think what really struck me about Tar is it's just peculiar, distinct tone. Because like on one level, everything that happens to the Tar over the course of the movie feels rooted in the real world. Like I think someone could watch this looking for a straight up drama and feel very satisfied. But the movie is shot, edited, scored, and even written when you think about like how it presents information to the viewer and the way characters like pop up throughout the narrative in a way that feels very hazy and uncanny.
Mm.
Almost like we're in Lydia Tarr's subconscious. Like it's like a nightmare she's having, or we're watching her in her head like try to manage this repressed guilt that she has. And those dreamlike elements and the everyday elements exist simultaneously but never clash. It's like the movie's operating on like two different planes of reality. And it's incredibly basic comparison, but the vibe reminded me of Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, which Todd Field is in.
Yeah,
he's
that's
the
true.
Piano player.
Yeah,
Nick Nightingale. Mm. And then the other thing about Tar is just Cate Blanchett's performance, maybe one of the greatest fully fleshed out distinct acting roles I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's true.
Characters love contradictory things at once. She's sort of a satire of an artist with an inflated ego. I start the clock. But you also never doubt that she is extremely talented. She's absolutely awful to a lot of people in her life, but is also very compelling and entertaining to be around. And there are moments like when she confronts her daughter's bully where you're watching go like, go get him, Tar!
Yeah.
She's tough and fierce and cruel, but also cringy and very vulnerable herself at times. And Blanchett threads a needle between all those things and... You know, without spoiling, like it's not only that Lydia Tarr goes in a big emotional journey throughout the film with many different stages, but Blanchett creates a character that feels so lived in from the very first moments, but then over the course of that film suddenly mines more and more greater depth to the extent that calls into question what you thought of her at the beginning of the movie. And like I think she's the reason why Lydia Tarr has taken on a life of her own. Like there are multiple articles online being like, no, Lydia Tarr is not real.
Yeah.
And then there was the fake Twitter account that posted as Lydia Tarr, and then the people who ran it, I imagine, got fed up of doing it, and so then they said that she died, and then news outlets covered it. Also, like, trifecta of incredible female supporting performances, like Nina Hoss as Lydia's wife and fellow classical musician, your beloved Naomi Merlant as Lydia's increasingly fed up assistant, and Sophie Cower as young cellist, as a young cellist that like Lydia becomes fixated on. Also, Mark Strong, awesome in this movie.
Terrible wig, though, as always.
I literally had written down, he plays this like investment banker, amateur conductor who helps fund Lydia's orchestra. Most perfect wig I've seen for a character, maybe, just in terms of like, you can tell he's like an investment banker, but he's like creative.
Yeah.
The wig is the way you get, the hair is how he expresses that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's true.
So yeah, no.
Five I love out of five. The bit where towards the end of the movie where her brother comes home to their like shitty home in New York or whatever, and he's played by Todd Field, I think.
Maybe. I'm not sure about that.
It was like, from far away anyway, and he goes oh hey Lorraine, sorry Lydia, and it just turns the movie on its head. It's like, oh, so it's all been a lie.
Yeah, it's so good. Do we want to do Oppenheimer, or actually I have the plot for it if you want. Number two.
No, go ahead. Yeah
Oppenheimer. Christopher Nolan's historical epic thriller about theoretical physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, and his role in overseeing the development of the first nuclear weapons during World War II, and also what happened to Oppenheimer after these weapons were used to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb,
they have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope. All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here. A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
Build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
What do you like about Oppenheimer?
What I like about Oppenheimer, I don't know. First of all, I don't know what it says about me or the year 2023, but the fact that three of my favorite movies of the year all deal either tangentially or directly with the development of nuclear weapons is concerning. Yeah. And I think like that sort of fear of nuclear weapons, like the doomsday clock that some of the Chicago Trinity scientists came up with after World War II, is like the closest it's ever been to midnight, which is like a metaphor for the closest we are to a man-made human catastrophe. And that sort of that fear forms the core or nucleus, if you will, of Oppenheimer. And I think this core is like orbited by two different stories, one from the point of view of Robert Oppenheimer and the other from Lewis Strauss, who's played by Robert Downey Jr., his perspective. And from wide, almost disparate beginnings, we circle closer and closer to this core, which, to be frank, had an atomic impact on me, that ending. So I went to see it with two friends who thought it was good, and I think it has grown in at least one of their estimations since. But the ending left me pretty shaken and feeling like someone had just poured boiling water into my skull. It felt like my synapses were on fire. It's a masterpiece in terms of like editing alone, but once you factor in the performances, the music, can you hear the music, Stephen? The cinematography and how Chris Nolan smashes it all together like atoms against each other in a fusion bomb, it instantly becomes one of the best films of the 21st century.
Yeah, I know.
What a cast. An endless parade of guys.
And a cast where it's like everyone needed to be famous because you really need to like see these guys one time and then know who they were if they show up later in the movie. No, really liked it. Well, obviously, it's my number one. I loved it.
Yeah. it was okay.
Because I'm a fan of Nolan generally, but I you can never really fault like the acting, the editing, the imagination that he has.
Yeah.
And I love his kind of mathematical plots where it's like, you know, Tenet's all like inverted, you know, Memento's told in reverse, Dunkirk is like the air, the sea, the land. And then the minute when they all like come together, it's just like magic, you know, at the end. But sometimes like I find
that key meat lock.
Yeah, but I think he strives for kind of like an emotion or a kind of human messiness, I think sometimes the movies tend to fall apart. Like I don't really like the boats bit in The Dark Knight. I'm not that mad about Interstellar. And also, I think he has kind of bad female characters, or like there's a lot of dead wives and stuff.
That's true. But if there's no dead wife, how can he feel pain?
Exactly. But what I mean to say was like I thought Oppenheimer was like a real step up in terms of like I thought it was really sprawling. Mm. I thought it was really not emotional in that like I'm rooting for J. Robert Oppenheimer. I was worried the movie would be kind of sympathetic towards him, and I think the movie is, I guess, not judgmental, but also not sympathetic. Like, yeah, I think he's like an awful person.
Yeah,
he's a womanizer.
I think
he's arrogant. He's cruel. But
you forgot brilliant.
Yeah, but you do kind of feel through Cillian Murphy's like performance, like the guilt, the kind of mental disintegration, the paranoia growth around him, and that stuff is really powerful. And like Emily Blunt, I think is I do again think the female characters do get short shrift.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think at
this stage,
though.
Yeah, they're better at this stage. Like well, he's what 24, 25 years into his film career. Maybe he's just bad at writing women, and we all just need to accept that and move on. To be frank.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I think Florence Pugh as well, like in her brief scenes in the movie, leaves such a huge impression, and then you really feel her absence.
Yeah.
Andrew's his eyes were really big. it feels like Nolan, you know, read that mammoth book, American Prometheus, which is what this is based on, biography of Oppenheimer, and just spent years working ahead to take its most compelling parts and fit them into a movie that could sustain all of them. And I think he cracked it. And the proof is that Oppenheimer is maybe 11 of the most compelling scenes I've seen in a movie, like in years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of everything I wanted to say.
Okay.
Yeah, no, so huge fan of Oppenheimer.
Yeah. Yeah. Grand.
Do you want to do your number one?
Yes. So my number one is Killers of the Flower Moon. Martin Scorsese's even more epic, certainly longer, movie. About Ernest Burkhart, who returns home from the first, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who returns home from the First World War to live with his uncle William King Hale, played by Robert De Niro, on the Osage Reservation, where the local Osage Native Americans have become wealthy thanks to the mineral rights to oil beneath their land. However, many of them, including the family of Ernest's wife Molly Kyle, played by a wonderful Lily Gladstone, are being murdered so that their white spouses or family or friends can take the land rights. The Bureau of Investigation sends agent Tom White, played by Jesse Plemons, to see about these murders and see who's doing them.
The Osage. They have the worst land possible. But they outsmarted everybody.
The land had oil on it.
Black gold. Money flows freely here now.
I do love that money, sir.
This wealth should come to us. Their time is over. It's just going to be another tragedy.
When this money starts coming, we should have known it came with something else. They're like buzzards circling our people. We're still warriors.
I ought to kill these white men who killed my family. I need you here.
I am right here.
So the two big building blocks of the United States of America are the genocide of Native Americans and the transatlantic slave trade. And without these, the so-called land of the free and home of the brave would not be what it is today. And in terms of what it's attempting to portray from the perspective that it's coming from, Killers of the Flower Moon does it about as well as it possibly can, while considering who it's made by, while retaining Martin Scorsese's unmistakable and unique gift for visual storytelling. So it can be hard to compare it to anything else, as there are so few movies and TV shows about, made by, and starring Native Americans. And even then, most are about the contemporary North Native American experience, namely the poverty and prejudice that defines the lives of so many that live on or off the reservations these days. And there are a few films that directly address the long-term genocide that took many forms in the period between the European settling of the North American continent and today. Killers of the Flower Moon is by far the longest and best of these few. There's a point halfway through the film where Molly's last remaining sister and her family are killed by a bomb planted on Ernest's orders. And when Molly's told, she lets out this long wailing scream that the edit mercifully cuts short. And it's a moment that's so raw and exposed, so devastatingly vulnerable that it feels like you shouldn't be watching it. And all you want to do is turn away, but there's nowhere to turn to in a cinema, really. And it gave me chills then, and it still gives me chills now. When I was writing my notes, I was like, ooh. And it was the moment I was convinced the movie was a masterpiece. The sprawling nature, however, of Killers of the Flower Moon allows for more than complete and utter misery, however. It's a very funny film, shockingly so sometimes, that bit where Louis Cancelmi is like, what if I adopted these kids and they died? And he's like, are you confessing that you're going to kill your children to me, Louis? Or whatever his name is. It's like, Jesus Christ.
I know the press screening. I saw that press screening and I got a big kind of gallows laugh. And then everyone was sort of like,
ooh,
I feel bad for laughing.
Yeah, yeah. It has gorgeous sweeping cinematography and an incredible score. And were it not for, as I said, Oppenheimer's endless parade of guys, it would have the most surprising cast of the year. Gene Jones, Jack White, Larry Fessenden, Pat Healy, Tatanka, son of Russell, Means, John Lithgow, Brendan Fraser, and again, Louis Cancelmi. All it's missing is Graham Greene and Gil Birmingham, but I assume Taylor Sheridan is keeping them busy. ultimately, it's a movie about the rotten heart of America, about how the white settlers poisoned the soil for the continent's native inhabitants and for their own future descendants. And there's no real righting the wrongs done in Killers of the Flower Moon. The Bureau of Investigation show up and do too little too late. Few are prosecuted, fewer are jailed, and that's true to life, and its ending shows that. All wounds can heal and form scars, but the pain can remain, and that seems to be what Killers of the Flower Moon is saying. We can try and make sense of how greed and complicity and cowardice can turn men like the Burkharts and Hale into paternalistic mass murderers, but catharsis remains impossible because of the nature of time, essentially. And there's no ending here, only Molly's scream echoing into eternity.
I thought it was very good.
Yeah.
My only issue is, like, and I've said this to you before, and you go and like, rolling your eyes, I never really get why Molly Burkhart is interested in Leonardo DiCaprio and does not suspect him in these crimes that are happening.
Mm.
I've seen people argue that, like, oh, well, there is this reasons, but just watching it for the first time, I didn't get that. But maybe on a rewatch again, kind of like Asteroid City, it would become more clear.
Yeah, in fairness, the book never really addresses it either.
I think it's a kind of a bug of, because that's a very short part of that book, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then they kind of blew that out, and I think they never kind of fundamentally cracked that. And I do think, and people will be like, it's based on a true story, and I understand that this did happen, but I don't think the movie, I bought the way Scorsese depicted that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah.
But I did think it was a great film.
Yeah.
All right, email inothefacepod@gmail.com if you'd like to reach out to the show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Please leave us an iTunes rating if you would be so kind. For those who want more of the pod, sub to Heads Up Plus for €5 plus tax a month, where you can listen to exclusive bonus episodes of the show. Andrew, where can people find more of your work?
Find me at the Heads Up Gaming section, where we talk about what we play, why we play, and how we play it, as well as at fortnightfrights.wordpress.com, where the next movie I'll be talking about will be The Curse of Frankenstein.
You can check me out at joe.ie. See you later, Sinfuzz.
Bye-bye.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.